session. God save the United States and the Southern Court.
Good morning. I'm Judge Mormon. To my right is Judge Lance. To my left is Judge Scholin. And before we get to the oral argument this morning, we have other court business to conduct. And I ask Mr. Kerry Sklar to step forward, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Kerry Sklar, and I am counsel to the clerk of the court. And I am pleased this morning to move the admission to the bar of this court of Mr. Lawrence H. Nemero. Mr. Nemero is a member of the bar of the state that was the 31st state to join the Union in 1850, and that is the great state of California. And I am pleased to say that Mr. Nemero has met all the qualifications for admission to the bar of this court.
Mr. Nemero, if you'll raise your right hand and repeat after me, or answer this question, rather. Do you solemnly swear to conduct yourself as an attorney and counselor of this court, uprightly and according to law, and that you will support the Constitution of the United States of America?
I so swear.
Thank you. Welcome to the bar.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations, Mr. Nemero.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We're here today in the matter of Irvin J. Edwards versus R. James Nicholson, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, docket number 041104. Would counsel for both parties, starting with the appellant, please note your appearance for the record.
Well, Your Honor, William Consovoy on behalf of Mr. Edwards.
And how do you spell your last name, please?
Consovoy.
Mr. Consovoy, welcome.
Mark McNabb for the Secretary. With me at counsel table is Joan Moriarty.
Thank you. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes.
Counsel for the appellant, Mr. Consovoy, is that correct? Do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
I do, Your Honor. 10 minutes.
Please. 10 minutes for rebuttal. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. This appeal arises from a denial of an earlier effective date for Mr. Edwards. At the outset, it is important to note that this issue, as the court's order recently reflects, this case involves three purely legal questions. Therefore, the clear error standard is inapplicable in this case. In any event, an error of law is always clear error. The court did appropriately frame the three important legal questions before the court in its recent order. First, whether the notice deprived Mr. Edwards of due process of law under the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution, whether due process requires tailored notice for individuals with mental disabilities, and third, whether, if the claim is successful, whether it should be applied retroactively to all pending cases. Beginning with due process, there is consistent law both from the Supreme Court and the courts of appeals, federal courts of appeals, that due process requires more notice than Mr. Edwards received. The notice he received was confusing and misleading.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. Had the property right vested?
Yes.
And why is that?
Applicants for it's an anomalous case. It's an interesting case here where he has already established entitlement. He's entitled to 50% disability for his disorder. So here, the question is not entitlement. The question is the effective date, which is slightly different than in a lot of the other cases where the question is whether an applicant has a due process right. He's not a pure applicant. He actually has an entitlement. If the question is whether an applicant has one, there is disagreement in lower courts. This is an unresolved issue. But there is a strong line of precedent, particularly from the Social Security cases where they have established that there is a vested property right here, that the question, as the Supreme Court framed it in Board of Regents v. Roth, is whether there's a legitimate entitlement as opposed to some speculative possible benefit. Veterans As the court is well aware, I have particular protection from the federal government under the system of law. They are, more than maybe any other system, designed to protect their rights, protect their interests, and there is a consistent view of the law that they have a strong entitlement, that every benefit of the doubt. And given that system, the answer should be in this case that yes, as either an applicant, he is entitled, he does have a vested property right, and alternatively that because he already established an entitlement, the question is not presented before the court in this case.
So it's your position that the timing of the notice in the process that the veteran went through in order to obtain an entitlement is irrelevant once he obtains entitlement?
With respect to whether the property interest has vested, once he has gained entitlement, he clears that particular hurdle. The time of the notice is certainly relevant for other aspects of the case, but for that purpose, he has established entitlement and thus a vested property interest. Once that threshold is crossed, under Matthews v. Eldridge, there's a three-part test to determine whether the notice sought is required under the Due Process Clause. Three-prong test has been established. One, what are the private interests affected? Two, what are the risks of erroneous deprivation? Three, what are the government's interests, including fiscal and administrative burdens? Under the first prong, there is strong precedent for the fact that notice clarifying the res judicata or preclusive effect of failure to submit new evidence is an important private interest, that the choice between appealing the initial decision under the facts and law as they're presented or submitting new evidence within a one-year period is a particularly important part of the case, that the beneficiary, the veteran here, has an important interest in making that choice. And without that knowledge, private interests are dramatically affected. In the Ninth Circuit case of Gonzales, which has been cited extensively in our papers, such a ruling was found in a closely analogous case where the notice of denial at issue did not make clear to the beneficiary that failure to produce or pursue new evidence within the statutory time period would affect their ability to recover the full amount. And this ruling has been followed up on, at least at its core level, in terms of the nature of the interest affected, in every circuit court. Even in the case decided by the government that seek additional showings beyond that, that point has not been disputed. The Sixth Circuit, the Eleventh Circuit, I believe the Tenth Circuit also.
Counselor, I'd like to jump ahead to you rely on Gonzales. The Secretary instead relies on Lujan versus Defenders of Wildlife in requiring detrimental reliance. Do you assert that detrimental reliance is something we should look for, and if so, does your client meet that?
I think there's several options here, all of which will lead to vindicating Mr. Edwards' interests. First, Gonzales, we think it's the right approach, that the due process violation is complete with the failure to notify, that no further showing is required. We think the logic of the court is strong and is better than the countering view from the 11th Circuit. Second, to the extent that some reliance is required, the Lujan standard is not the appropriate standard here for several reasons. First, the Lujan comes from the 11th Circuit Loudermilk case. And that was just an erroneous citation by the 11th Circuit. The causal link, the direct proximate link required in a case like Lujan for Article III standing is not the proper standard here for several reasons. First, in the case itself, the 11th Circuit cited a Sixth Circuit case called Davey Shalala as a precedent for that standard, but it misread the case. The type of reliance talked about in Davey Shalala is a far less standard than what is issued here. And if I might quote the case, it says, a claimant relied to his or her detriment on the inadequate notice if he or she was denied benefits at the reconsideration level, then received inadequate notice, and thereafter filed a new application rather than continuing the appeal process, and then were presented by the secretary with a claim of res judicata or received less in retroactive benefits than he or she would have received had they successfully appealed initially. The 11th Circuit read that as saying you must have proved by direct evidence that you would have successfully appealed or you would have taken certain actions. That's not what the Sixth Circuit's saying. In fact, under the Sixth Circuit standard, Mr. Edwards easily meets it. There was inadequate notice. He was denied benefits. He thereafter pursued new evidence instead of the initial appeal. And
I'm sorry, I'd like to stop you right there.
Yeah.
You said he pursued new evidence. Could you point to me in the record where he submitted additional evidence? I believe he filed a claim.
Right, and he returned for the physical at a later date, which in that, in connection with my understanding with his medical records, which were eventually reviewed, which were had been slow and, you know, it took many years to locate his initial medical records that proved he had a disability dating back to 1978. That was how the reopened case was eventually vindicated in his favor. And the last point here is that even if the 11th Circuit was right in its case to look to a Lujan proximate cause standard, here this court has the rule of prejudicial error already in place under the Mayfield decision, which was reversed on other grounds, but still is, as far as I can, good law on the point that this court has set the allocation of burdens for a standard of proof with respect to claims such, or at least analogous notice claims. And there, the standard was not this direct proximate cause. It was, it might have changed the result. And there is a presumption, at least in that notice case, that it followed in the class of claims that shifted the burden to the government to prove a lack of prejudice. And we
have Mr. Edwards ever asserted that he didn't understand the notice?
As far as I can tell, the record's not clear. And I think that, in large measure, is a product of his circumstance. That there's evidence that he was homeless. There's evidence from the VA when he reported in 1987 that he was disheveled and disoriented. And that evidence is in the record. I think that the court... There are several options. The court believes that there is a property interest that has been violated here, that the court could review the record and determine whether, if they require a causation element, that the court could look at the record and make that finding that this is the type of, first, that this is the type of notice violation, regardless of the individual, that falls within the type of claim that will produce an unfair process, which, again, is evidence in Mayfield, or the court could, as other circuits have, including the Fourth Circuit and the First Circuit, remand this matter back to the board for determination of that second prong. If the court makes the legal finding that a violation has occurred, at least at the first step, but that whether there was reliance under whatever standard the court would find appropriate, that there was such reliance.
Counsel, what if this notice did not include the paragraph on new evidence? Would that change things?
It would make it a different case, but would not change the outcome.
Are there errors elsewhere in this notice then?
Yes. If I could turn to it briefly, there's a couple problems here, and this is cited in our paper. On record 191, which is the opposite side of the page, it says that informing him that he did not submit to the exam, it says, if you do so, an examination will be rescheduled and the claim will be reconsidered when the examination is completed. That again contributed to the confusion or the misleading notice, and that is very similar to what occurred in Gonzales, where there was information presented that you can fix this. Your claim can be reconsidered, and no mention of the prejudicial effect of failing to do so within the statutory period. So that also contributed to the error, as well as the new evidence paragraph. And it's important.
Let's go to 192 of the record. Okay, you may appeal our decision to the Board of Veterans' Appeals at any time within 1 year from the date of this letter. Period. Is that confusing to anybody?
No, that alone is not confusing. The problem is that there's a distinction drawn between appealing the decision now and presenting new evidence. And if the court continue on with that, right after that it says, if you believe the decision is not in accord with the law and the facts now of record. So if putting aside mental disability for a second, this alone leads to confusion for any veteran, because they say, okay, here's the record and the law as it exists now. You can appeal that, and you have a year to do that. But if you'd rather submit new evidence, if that's the course you want to take, here's what you do. Just submit it. And doesn't explain, as in Gonzales and a number of other cases, that failure to do so within the 1 year period leads to a reduction in benefits. and the reduction of that benefit leads to the due process violation in this case.
But in that same paragraph is the offer to explain and to assist and so forth. The last sentence, I believe, if you decide to appeal, we will advise you further.
Right, right.
Didn't that place somebody on an inquiry notice? What does this mean? How are my rights affected? Do I really have 1 year? I mean, aren't these questions that reasonable people would ask?
I think that helps. I think it does help. But again, that is with respect to the appeal. There's a clear distinction drawn, and I think that the language that says with the law and the facts now of record, it really contributes to the problem here, because I think a reasonable person would say, okay, if I want to appeal the record as this now, I have a year, and they're going to help advise me on my appellate process. But if I want to submit new evidence, I just need to go ahead and do it. And there's no limit on that, period. And then if you turn to the other side and you say, okay, I think that if I come and agree to have the physical examination and it's rescheduled, my claim will be reconsidered. Again, there, and I would draw the court's attention to some language from Fleshman v. West, where I think there's a better notice going on there. There's a better process given, where it says, the court said, part of it's a quote and part of it's a paraphrase from the notice, which I don't have, but it says, if the form, there was an incomplete form, if the form was not returned within a year of the date of the letter, benefits will not be paid prior to the date of the receipt. Now, if that sentence was added to the end of the new evidence paragraph, that would be a notice that, without drawing any firm conclusions, would at least be closer to the line. And in fact, in the government's brief, on page 11, the government does a far better job of explaining what it meant in two sentences than it did in the notice. It said, in analyzing that particular new evidence paragraph, it said, the secretary contends that the information above is accurate. Appellant may at any time submit additional evidence. If submitted during the one-year period, it may lead to reconsideration of his current claim. If submitted after and it rises to the level of new and material evidence, it may be cause of reopening the denied claim. That's just two sentences compared to one, but is far more accurate with respect to the state of the law and respect to the Mr. Edwards' rights.
Are you familiar with this court's case in Morris versus Derwinski?
Yes.
Okay. And you're asking us to overrule that?
I reviewed it again this morning, in fact, and there is language in there that would lead to needing to reverse it. What's interesting is the citation to Gonzales and the concurrence, I think, leads to questions as to whether it's really a straight overruling. It's not clear that all, I mean, it does mention there's a due process challenge and that under the Merrill case. But if you look at Mullane and Memphis Light and cases after that from the Supreme Court, it's not clear that those cases were either presented to the court, or I don't have the briefs, or whether those issues were argued about the difference between being on notice generally as to regulatory enactments and whether there's an affirmative misleading notice coming back to you that produces error. There may be differences there. And second of all, which the court hasn't addressed yet, which is Mr. Edwards' mental disabilities may make this just a different case, and that may lead to
In that regard, didn't the court in Memphis Light zero in on the fact that the individual involved there was a quote-unquote known incompetent and that the notice was published in the newspaper?
That's right. That's right. And that it was a newspaper that the individual was unlikely to see. Here, there is ample evidence in the record predating this notice here of Mr. Edwards' mental disabilities. And even more so, given the system of law surrounding this case, a veteran who is involved in a system designed to protect his right, that is designed to be non-adversarial as much as possible, is entitled to even further protection and from the veteran.
How are we on appeal to judge this, the depth or breadth of the appellant's mental disability? Diagnosed as schizophrenia, I find a variety of descriptions of what the effect is on his intellect. I also find in the record statements that appear to have been submitted in support of the claim on a number of occasions by Mr. Edwards. that appear to be fairly articulate. How do you deal with that, or how should the court deal with that?
Well, I think the court has two avenues it could pursue here. First, the court could look at the record. First, there's been a diagnosis of a mental disability that is not in dispute. Now, the impact of that is open to interpretation. But again, there is evidence in the record suggesting that he appeared disoriented and confused when he appeared in 1987. I believe that's at record. And the numbers are cut off at the bottom. I believe it's 120. Yes, 120. The other option for the court would be to remand for a factual finding on that issue alone. And that's what's been done by the Fourth Circuit. That's what's been done by the First, where the court says, all right, there's been a prima facie showing. There's a colorable constitutional claim here that the mental disability existed and that it impacted the case. And again, it's not the direct causal link language that's relevant. It's the it might have affected the fairness of the proceeding.
Has any state court declared him to be non compos mentis and appointed a conservator of his person or his estate?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor.
All right. Wouldn't that be the acid test?
I think that would be a winning point for Mr. Edwards, but the absence of it would not necessarily cost him the case.
And your argument would be that if we had an appellant who was in a coma, let's say, and his 1 year was about to expire, that the facts of that particular hypothetical case would require us to basically analyze every appellant's condition, mental or otherwise, in applying these standards.
If the court follows this down the line, then a person who is mentally disabled, whether in a coma, that can mean two things. One is that can entitle them to more notice. That unless of course someone's been appointed in their interest at that point, and therefore they had some.
Hasn't the Federal Circuit set a fairly high standard with regard to the effect of mental illness on tolling of the time to file an appeal in this court in Barrett?
Yes. It was fairly high standard, yes, but the equitable tolling jurisprudence is slightly different in that there's a different test at stake. Equitable tolling requires an approximate link because it's the court's acting out of its discretion to reach an equitable result. Here, the question is not what is the equitable result, it's what's required by the United States Constitution. I see my time has expired.
I'd like to extend for a moment.
Sure.
Getting to what the Constitution requires, the Secretary relies on Cook to say that the way that Mr. Edwards should have addressed his claim that his notice was not good and therefore abating the finality of the 88 decision is either through a Q claim or by new material evidence. And that he argues, I believe, that those are the two remedies that the statute provides to a potential constitutional violation. How do you argue that there is an extra remedy?
Cook is not implicated in this case at all. Cook involves exceptions to finality. This is a slightly different but important difference. This is not an exception to finality. This is a question of whether the claim became final in the first instance. I would point to the court to DiCarlo from its, the court's recent case in DiCarlo. It says there's two different questions. And this was not when Mr. Edwards is not seeking a statutory exception or an equitable exception to finality.
Well, it seems to me that the cases in Tablazon, Hawk, Kuo, that line of cases, that the appellant is waiting for the secretary to do something. They can't proceed. In this case, the appellant, in theory, could have proceeded by filing an appeal to the board. So is that really the same rationale of finality hasn't attached because the secretary hasn't done what he's supposed to do?
Right. I think those are two different things. The one where the secretary's failed to do something does not, those aren't, my understanding, aren't due process claims. Those are failure to assist claims. Here we're saying it's the notice that produced the due process violation. and due process leads to a pending claim that is not final. For instance, in Meeks, there was an application filed in 1970 that was deemed to be non-final and pending for 20 some odd years. That is rare, but not uncommon legally.
Yes, but the recent jurisprudence out of the Federal Circuit potentially leads us to believe that a unadjudicated claim in that circumstance has to be raised through Q.
I would take a different view of Cook, Your Honor. I would say that Cook says you can't look for other statutory remedies or statutory obligations of the government and use those as exceptions to finality. Because once the case becomes final with the court, jurisdiction attaches and the court has no power to act. The question here and the question in DiCarlo, and I think the question preserved by the court in Cook when it said this is different than cases where, with respect to failure to advise of appellate rights, that when the Constitution is implicated, it's not a question of an exception to finality. It's a question of whether finality ever occurred in the first instance. And because of a due process notice violation in this case, due process finality never attached. The claim remains pending and non-final.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for VA.
Good morning. May it please the court. The case before you offers the issue of whether appellant is entitled to an effective date prior to January of 1997 for the grant of service connection for his psychiatric disorder. He does not. Appellant filed a claim that was denied in August of 1981, was not appealed and became final. He filed a claim to reopen that was denied in March of 1988. That was not appealed and thus it became final. He ultimately filed a second claim to reopen some 9+ years later, and the effective date assigned when the claim was ultimately granted was the appropriate one to January 1997, his claim. Appellant contends that the court should hold that the March 1988 decision has not become final because the notice given to him with that decision is sufficiently similar to that in the Ninth Circuit's 1990 Gonzales v. Sullivan case. The court should reject his argument for a number of reasons. First, we do believe that Cook is implicated and that appellant has only two means by which to overcome the finality of that decision. And while he ultimately did choose one by submitting new material evidence, he's not alleged Q, which is the other. This court has not held that due process considerations apply to claimants that have not established entitlement to a benefit. And they've discussed that in the Ferber and Anderson cases, and even yesterday's Prickett case, the court has not held that due process considerations apply to applicants. We believe, however, the court need not address that question because appellant has not submitted reason to adopt a test similar to Gonzales, and even if the court were to adopt the test similar to Gonzales, the VA's notice given at the time was sufficient, even under the Gonzales test.
Counsel, answer me this question. Why is it not misleading to tell the claimant that he can submit new evidence after an unfavorable decision without telling him about the one-year cutoff, after which time he'll lose his effective date? Is that an impossible burden for the Secretary to meet?
We believe the notice given in that section is accurate, as stated in our original brief. And we believe that there was no duty to give him any additional information about if he submitted additional evidence, how that would impact his claim.
Well, let's get away from the concept of duty, but just common sense. I mean, how much of a burden would it be to add a line to your notice?
Well, it would not be. In fact, notice given later in this same case includes such information. Okay. We're no longer, so far as I know, giving a notice that matches this given in 1988.
So adding a few words basically to the notice would avoid all of this confusion, right?
Well, I don't believe there's any confusion here. Appellant wasn't...
Well, appellant seems to indicate that there is.
Well, appellant believes so now, but appellant before this court in his brief explicitly refused to challenge the finality of the 1988 decision. So appellant now believes that it's confusing, but when appellant came before this court in this same case, he briefed the non-finality of the 1981 decision, challenging it on great procedural error grounds, but in that brief explicitly refused to challenge the finality of the 1988 decision. So,
But in response to Gonzales, the Social Security Administration clarified basically its notice so that everybody understood the game?
Well, the Ninth Circuit, there are cases in which the other circuits refuse to hold that Gonzalez's test should be applied to their circuit, that an error in notice alone is not sufficient to vitiate finality in that case of a otherwise final Social Security decision.
Well, that's a legal conclusion, but I'm just saying adding a sentence to clarify wouldn't be that much of a burden, would it?
That's correct. And so far as I know, that's been done. So any decision about a 1988 notice here wouldn't affect the Secretary in that respect at all.
Okay. Thank you.
The reason we believe that that Gonzalez shouldn't be adopted in a case such as this are that the notice given here satisfies the concerns articulated even by the Gonzalez court. In particular, Gonzalez court noted, quote, that one of the fundamental requirements of procedural due process is that a notice be reasonably calculated to afford parties their right to present objections. Well, it's quite clear from the notice at record 192 that if appellant, that if he believes the decision is not in accord with the law and the facts now of record, he may appeal the decision at any time within 1 year. It explains to him what's necessary to begin that process, how to do that, and that additional notice will be forthcoming if he files such a notice of disagreement. So,
if you would, please, contrast the notice here with the notice in Gonzalez, where the notice said, if you do not request consideration of your case within the prescribed time, you still have the right to file another application at any time.
Well, there are two differences. One, those two things are in one sentence in the Gonzalez notice. And so the possibility for confusion is greater. Second, what the Gonzalez notice invites is a new application. There's no such invitation in the notice given here. As to the claim that's been filed, it clearly explains that if he disagrees, how to proceed, and that additional notice will be forthcoming upon that notice of disagreement. Again, the information given about new evidence is accurate. Insofar as it's incomplete, we would point to this court's Woods case that looked at the duties of the Secretary at the time, and in Woods, it was determined that the duties were under the then existing version of 3.103E, that VA was required to notify the claimant of the decision. That was done here, and that under then existing 38 CFR 19.114, the claimant and the representative, if any, will be informed of the right to initiate an appeal and the time within which to do so.
Statutory or regulatory requirements don't vitiate a failure of due process under the Constitution, do they?
No, that's right. And why we, again, point out that this court's not held that such a requirement would apply to an applicant in this case, we also believe that that the Gonzalez court's concerns, even if you adopted the test, are not implicated by this notice. One, for the reason I already put forward, that the Gonzalez court was concerned with the that the notice be calculated to afford the parties their right to present objections, which this one did. The Gonzalez court, in discussing Judge Lance's question, said that quote, requiring notices to accurately state how a claimant might appeal an initial decision does not impose a significant financial or administrative burden on the Secretary. So again, the Gonzalez court was interested in large measure that the notice accurately state how a claimant might appeal, and again, the notice given in this case is quite clear in that respect. So given that the types of notices here are not the same, even if were the court to adopt a Gonzalez-type test, we believe that the notice met the concerns of Gonzalez, that appellant...
Mr. McNabb, if I may interject. It seems to me that in many of the Social Security cases, the concern does seem to be the preclusive effect on receiving retroactive benefits. And why would that not be applicable to this case?
Well, although the cases aren't clear, at least to me, it seems that the way the Social Security system is set up is that after even a four-year period, there's a fully preclusive problem there. It doesn't exist here because of the statutory options for non-finality that are presented, that is, Q or new material evidence. This person can move to reopen his claim at any time and challenge a final decision.
Well, under new material, it's still only prospective, though. he wouldn't retain his earlier effective date, which I think is very similar to the result that would be in Social Security.
That's right. Although in a Q circumstance, he would retain an original date. So he does have an option, if there was an error in the original claim, to challenge the finality of that decision here that doesn't exist in the Social Security context.
So if this appellant were to raise this notice violation that he asserts in the context of a Q claim, would that likely lead to him receiving retroactive benefits?
No, I don't believe this type of error is the type of error that would be Q.
So saying he could raise it in Q is really a hollow remedy for him.
I'm just saying that there are other options for to challenge the finality of a decision that don't seem to exist in Social Security context.
I noticed that in the board decision, the board sua sponte implied a Q claim and then denied it. Does that have some sort of preclusive effect on the appellant raising a Q claim in the future?
No. In fact, there was, I believe, an RO decision that also, that's incorrect. A Q claim can be raised at any time, and unless it's precisely the same Q claim, then the decision would have no preclusive effect.
Is the fact that the appellant didn't actually raise a Q claim a factor at all? That this decision might have been ultra vires by the board or something?
It may have been. If he articulated the same precise one, then there could be an issue there. But that's certainly not before us here. So in addition to believing that the notice given satisfies the concerns of the Gonzales court, we do think that the other circuits, having rejected this sort of one-prong error alone, is sufficient view, should be adopted if this court is going to consider the issue. And again, appellant responded to our supplemental brief by saying that the Berks-Marshall court is only about standing. But in fact, that's the question in all of these Social Security cases, because the Social Security cases don't get before federal court without a constitutional challenge. And so the question looked at in Gonzales, as well as in Loudermilk and Day and Berks-Marshall, is whether or not there is a due process claim.
With regard to the other lines of cases other than Gonzales and the requirement for some nexus or detrimental reliance, how would that be demonstrated in this case other than the fact that the appellant didn't appeal?
Well, if appellant had come in, again, we don't think the notice is inaccurate or misleading, but if appellant came in 13 months later and said, here's new evidence that goes with my claim, might that question be raised? Possibly. But what happened in this case was that appellant did not respond for almost 9 years, and when he did so with an application that clearly was not an intent to continue an old claim. In fact, he marked the box in that application when asked if he'd filed a claim with the VA before. He said no. So there's clearly no intent in this new claim 9 years later to show that he was misled by the previous decision.
What is the court to conclude from the fact that he marked the box at a later time, know that he had never filed a claim, when in fact we know that he had filed a claim?
Regardless of whether it's accurate or not, it shows that he was not misled by this notice into thinking he could submit new evidence to tag on to this old claim at any time. There's certainly no evidence.
Could we not also conclude that he didn't understand what was going on?
I think, given the overall submissions from this appellant, that there's no cause to consider that. Appellant has responded to requests for additional evidence, even when VA misunderstood his claim in 1987 into thinking it was simply a head injury claim. Appellant wrote back to respond to make clear that he also intended a separate psychiatric problem claim.
Appellant has argued that we might follow the test created by some of the circuits to send, or not test, but remedy, to remand the case back to the agency to assess his mental, the effect his mental defect might have effect on his ability to pursue his claim. Is that something the Secretary could engage in?
Well, it's possible that the Secretary could engage in that sort of fact-finding. We believe that the facts in this case don't raise this issue.
Would the Secretary's position be that that would be an inappropriate action for the court to take?
Absolutely. Such an initial fact-finding would not be appropriate for this court. In addition, we don't believe that there's anything in this record that shows it. We also, in looking at those circuit cases, such as Schrader cited in the court's order, the court required presentation of prima facie proof that the mental illness prevented him from understanding the procedure necessary to obtain an evidentiary hearing, and specifically held that the claimants must present prima facie evidence of incompetency. There is no evidence of record that appellant is incompetent, and in fact, in later findings, he was found competent for VA purposes to handle his funds, but the record is silent as to any showing of incompetency, and so the cases such as Schrader or the Fourth Circuit's follow-up to Schrader in Brown that pointed out that that the Secretary in that case was not required to make an initial inquiry about the mental competency of each applicant, but instead claimant had a burden of presenting prima facie evidence of incompetency to the Secretary, and this record is silent as to any such finding.
Counsel, the Secretary has equitable authority, does he not, in cases similar to this? If he chose to exercise.
Sure.
Okay. And is there any evidence of record that would indicate that the appellant in this case requested of the Secretary some sort of equitable relief?
I don't believe there's any such request in the record.
Thank you.
So we believe that, as stated in our original brief, that the Woods v. Gover case makes clear what the Secretary's duties were. Those duties have clearly not have been met, and appellant didn't challenge that those have been met, but simply urges the adoption of a standard that has been rejected by many circuits, and insofar as an added prong of the necessity of showing harm is required in those other circuits, and that further, even in just sticking to the text of the Gonzalez case and its concerns, the Secretary's notice has clearly met the concerns that the Gonzalez court articulated.
If we could presume, for the sake of argument, that the notice did constitute a constitutional due process violation, would the appellant's only remedies still be Q and no material evidence?
Absent a holding by this court that, for the first time, that applicants had such protections, then yes.
Okay. If we had a holding that he was entitled to such protections, then would he have other avenues of redress?
Well, if the court held the decision was not final, then the agency would then consider the appropriate effective date. But given that the decision at the time was that the evidence was insufficient on which to rate him, and that he did not then submit or produce any additional evidence until after his claim, more than 9 years later, it's difficult to see how the agency would come to a different determination about that time period. There are no further questions?
Okay. No, thank you, Counsel. Mr. Consular?
Your Honors, in rebuttal, government's reliance on Wood v. Gover is misplaced. As Judge Mormon suggested, that case deals with the government's regulatory duty under existing statutes and regulation at the time to provide certain notice or not provide other notice. That is not the question before the court today. The question before the court today is whether the notice that was given violates the Constitution. And pointing to statutes that existed at the time is not sufficient to overcome that claim. So Wood is not relevant to this case at all. The government also stated...
Let me interrupt you for just one second, Counsel. Don't Covey and Gonzalez both agree that a fundamental requirement of procedural due process is that a notice must be reasonably calculated to afford the parties a right to present objections to what's going on? I mean, isn't that the purpose of notice?
My reading of the case is notice is slightly broader than that. That it's not just objections. It's that it's notice of all your rights.
So a meaningful opportunity to participate in a meaningful way presented at a meaningful time.
Absolutely.
That's some of the cases.
That's right. And under that standard, Mr. Edwards was deprived of those rights because had he been aware, he should have been made aware of the fact that failure to submit new evidence within the one-year period was going to reduce the benefits he was accorded. And that's what the court found in Gonzales. Now, the only difference between the Gonzales notice and this notice is that they use the words at any time and makes it arguably, you know, slightly more misleading. But if you look at this notice at Record 192, in conjunction with 191, that says if you submit to the physical examination at a later date, your claim will be reconsidered. That those two, 191 and 192 of the record together, produce essentially the same point that was misleading in Gonzales, that there's no one-year period, that whether you submit to the physical examination within 1 year or after 1 year, there's no difference. Here, there's a substantial difference.
Isn't VA faced with kind of a dilemma here? It's trying to execute a uniquely pro-veteran, non-adversarial system consistent with things like saying, if you decide to show up for an exam later, we'll consider that. Or if you present new evidence later, we'll consider that. Isn't that consistent with that which is unique to VA? And how do you suggest that the agency balance that against a narrowly tailored, due process compliant notice of appellate rights?
I mean, that's a good point, Your Honor. The VA is in a uniquely pro-claimant system, although the Social Security cases the courts have found are quite close and didn't preclude, including Loudermilk and Gonzales, all those cases, again, don't disagree with the core point that the notice was confusing. The Loudermilk only disagreed on what further showings were required. And here, again, what this would maybe be a different case if the question was, is he entitled to a claim at all? The court's not being confronted with whether he's entitled to recover benefits for his disorder. That's been resolved in his favor. This is a much more narrow question. And the question then becomes is, if the court finds the notice is confusing to the level that it rises to a constitutional dimension, who bears the burden of that error? Is it the VA or is it Mr. Edwards?
Well, let's talk about what the effect would be if we were to find that there was such a notice error. As the Secretary just said, they didn't have enough evidence to decide Mr. Edwards' claim back in 88, and they didn't have that potentially until such time as he underwent an exam.
Right.
So what would the effective date be?
The effective date, per the papers filed by counsel of record, they seek an effective date of when he filed that initial notice to reconsider, which I believe is July 14, 1986. Now, if the court were to vindicate Mr. Edwards' claims here, the way it would be resolved is that claim remained open for the entire duration until he submitted to that physical exam. At the physical exam, he was vindicated. He was found to be 50% disabled. Therefore, it reverts because it's still within the statutory, quote unquote, within the statutory period. It reverts back to that date. An interesting question, and I would concede this was not presented in our papers, was, I believe the board decision below stated that had he actually submitted to the exam, he would have been entitled to an effective date from 1978 because, I think I'm reading the decision correctly, that new to the regulations, but that he would have, because of the unique procedural errors of that case in finding his medical record. So, but again, I can see that's not been briefed, but I think that the answer is straightforward. The medical exam would then have been within the statutory period. He was vindicated in that exam, and therefore he gets July 14, 1986 as an effective date.
Counsel, Mr. McNabb represented that your client never requested equitable relief from the Secretary. Is that accurate?
I don't have any information to dispute that, Your Honor.
I
don't have any counter information. I'd have to look the record and speak to counsel record. I don't know differently.
So what you're seeking basically is an equitable remedy, and this court has precious little equitable power. But the Secretary does, so it would seem to me that wouldn't your remedy lie with the Secretary's statutory and regulatory powers?
I would slightly disagree, Your Honor. We do raise equitable tolling in the brief. That has not been an issue discussed before the court here. That raises some slightly different questions, and I think some a little bit of a harder question for, candidly, for Mr. Edwards. But we're not asking the court to exercise its equitable powers when we talk about constitutional due process. Constitutional due process is grounded in equity, but it's a constitutional requirement that no one has the discretion to avoid, neither the board nor this court nor any government official. If due process was violated, it's not a discretionary act in the court. It's a constitutional violation that the remedy is mandatory.
But your pleadings would suggest that one of your theories of the case is that your client was mentally incapable of understanding all of this information, and that someone ought to extend his time frame, which is a classic equitable prayer for relief.
The primary argument is that this notice is misleading, period.
Okay. That's the primary argument.
That's the primary.
I understand.
If the court doesn't accept that argument or finds that to be just pushing the law too far, there is good case law out there that suggests that question can be impacted by the mental state of the applicant. And we've cited a number of those cases in our papers. If the court were to reach that, then the question of whether he is mentally incompetent raises a host of issues beyond the pure constitutional question and some equitable questions as the court, as Your Honor raised. Now that brings the court back to, well, who bears the burden? And government suggests the Loudermilk standard, which is a heavy burden on Mr. Edwards. We suggest that either Gonzalez, which basically says due process violation is complete on the act, end of story, or at least this court's standard in Mayfield for notice violations, which says a notice violation like this is presumed to be prejudicial because it fundamentally undermines the fairness of the proceeding, and therefore the burden shifts to the government to prove a lack of prejudice. And that can be resolved in two ways. One, the court could show that the government has failed to make that finding based on their papers, which I don't see a strong record in their papers proving, you know, if the burden is on the government, proving a lack of prejudice, or at a minimum, as the Fourth Circuit and the First Circuit have done, remand that to the board. But to be clear, if the court does remand, the court would set the standard before the remand that the court, we would hope, if there's going to be a remand, adopt that standard in Mayfield for the government's need to show lack of prejudice. Just to sum up, and the government has made a to Judge Lance's question that there's no real administrative or financial burden here, that this notice is no longer used, that this is sort of an anomalous case of a sad set of facts for this individual. That's really important in two ways. One, that's the third factor of the Matthews test. What are the government's burdens? What kind of burden does the government bear? If the court finds that there was a private interest at stake in accurate notice here, and you move to the equitable factors, the government has essentially, I believe, conceded those equitable factors. Second, on retroactivity, the third part of retroactivity are the equities involved in having retroactive effect, and what are the burdens going to be? Here, the government is basically saying there are no burdens. This is not a systemic problem. So therefore, under both the due process point and on the retroactivity point, I think that concession is telling.
Let me take just 1 minute of your time here, counsel, just to wrap up in my own mind. In looking at record 192, we have a page here that's titled Notice of Procedural and Appellate Rights. And then it says, this explains your procedural and appellate rights. And then it goes through representation either by an attorney or by a VSO representative. And it talks about the fact that you can present new evidence, and we'll carefully consider it, and it's in your interest to present it as promptly as possible. Then it advises him that he has a right to a hearing where he can bring witnesses and prepare, and the VA will prepare a transcript. And then it gives him the notice of appellate rights together with the timing issue. When we analyze this page, and the preceding page with regard to this issue of fundamental due process, procedural due process. How are we to examine it? Shall we parse it, or shall we examine the totality of it? What does the law tell us? The
law essentially tells you both, that you need to take a holistic view of it, but you also need to look at whether there was first you have to see whether there was something inaccurate or misleading about it, and just at a core level. Then you need to say, well, what type of effect did that have on the overall proceeding? What, you know, does it produce, you know, an overall confusion? I think under either way, whether the court parses it or looks at it as a whole, the problems don't change. I think just comparing it to Fleshman v. West is the easiest way to just show the problem. I would just again quote that case. If the form was not returned within a year of the date of the letter, benefits will not be paid prior to the date of the receipt. That's it. That's essentially it. And the government says essentially that on page 11 of its brief in two sentences in an attempt to justify the misleading nature of the original notice. And then Gonzales says the same thing, and the cases preceding Gonzales, debating back to 1984 in the Social Security Act context. So whether the court looks just at this paragraph or at the entire form, I think the answer is the same, particularly, and I would just, in concluding, say, I really do think that the words in the appeal section where it says, in accord with the law and the facts now of record, is a problem in conjunction. You just can't look at the new evidence alone. That would lead any reasonable veteran to think that if I want to appeal, it's about the record now. If I want to go new evidence, it's I have as much time as I really want.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The case will be submitted for consideration. The court, before adjourning, will now greet counsel.